really lovely to see so many of you here. I don't think I've actually been in this hot seat for a while, actually. I haven't given that many talks last year at the centre, but I was probably more involved in classes and other retreats and things. But, and when we were in January, sometimes it's a bit of a struggle to get people to lead these evenings. Well, there were a number of us who put our names forward, and I was very inspired at that time. I thought, oh, great, I can do something on going forth. And then just recently I've been thinking, why did I say that, you know? Because it's always quite a bit of work. And the company has been encouraging me just to write down 3 points and then just speak. But I actually, in this sort of situation, I do find it easier to have notes, so just bear with me, Akampia. But and this talk was inspired around going forth and renunciation and a little bit around the worldly winds, which you'll see how they all kind of tie in together. And I've sort of drawn aspects of it from there were 2 retreats last year. There was the Taste of Freedom retreat, which I co-led with Kuslamani, where we drew on quite a lot of Paramananda's book, A Deeper Beauty, actually. It's a lovely book up here, which is well worth reading, around, you know, exploring different ways to experience freedom from a Buddhist perspective, and which is very closely connected with renunciation and going forth. And then on the New Year's retreat, some of you are here from the New Year's retreat, we were exploring the worldly winds. So I've sort of drawn a bit from a presentation I gave there as well, and, you know, added a few extra things. So I would like to acknowledge Paramananda and Vajragupta, because he's written a wonderful book called Sailing the Worldly Winds. And a woman I met called Tara Vandana at the international convention in India early last year, who was very, very open and receptive to sharing resources. So she sent me some fantastic notes on the worldly winds, and we kind of used a few of those at Christmas. So in Buddhism, it's sometimes said that the spiritual life begins with renunciation. And this is often symbolised by the Buddha's own going forth from his very privileged early life into the life of a wandering seeker who eventually discovered the true nature of reality. And we often think of renunciation as a sort of outward act of giving up a materialistic lifestyle. And this is true to some extent, but it's also very much an internal going forth. And this internal going forth is a journey of acknowledging and slowly letting go of our fixed beliefs and ideas. And in Buddhism, meditation can be very helpful as a tool for helping us to let go. So, you know, just sitting with our breath and the arising and falling away nature of our thoughts and what's going on in our mind and our body are very excellent opportunities for all sorts of fantasies and, you know, all sorts of distractions to kind of arise, and fears and anxieties. But what we do in meditation is we learn to accept them with a kindly awareness, and we begin to see how they arise and fall away. And as we watch them arise and fall away, we start to get a sense that most of what goes on in our minds is a construction of unnecessary complexity that we add to our actual direct experience. And a simple example of that in meditation is we might have we might develop a little pain in our leg or some discomfort in the leg. And we may get to the point where it just gets bigger and bigger and we think, you know, I'm just going to give up. There's no point meditating today. You know, what's the point of meditation anyway? But if, in actual fact, if we can actually just sit with the sensations with kindly awareness, often what they do is they shift and change and sometimes even pass away. And if we can keep being diligent about this, about sort of being with our experience and not running away from it in meditation, what happens is that we can slowly start to do that in our everyday lives as well. So we start to see that we overcomplicate our experience, and in time the constant mind chatter that is often fueled by craving and anxiety slowly diminishes. And so this tool of meditation can give us the experience of being content with just being with how things are. And this is actually a kind of doorway into renunciation. So renunciation, you know, does also include letting go of material things and also situations that no longer serve us. And, you know, often what happens when we let things go is that we find ourselves trying to replace them very quickly with something else. And sometimes we even get the replacement before we've let the things go. So we might give away an old couch, but only after the new one is delivered. Or we might start a new relationship before we've said goodbye to the old partner. And there can be a deep anxiety about not having that thing or that situation in our lives, which kind of drives us to do that. And it's a type of grasping, which is based on fear. And it can be hard to get to the cause of the fear, but it is often connected to overinvesting in the meaning of things. And our sense of self-worth can be unconsciously bound up in what we own and what we think we can control. So our founder, Sangharakshita, says that if we really have some degree of insight into the true nature of existence and have really to some extent seen the inadequacy of material things, then our hold on them will be relaxed and we will be quite willing and happy to let at least some of them go. And he also says there is no single uniform pattern of renunciation. Different people will give up different things first. But the net result is the same, to make life simpler and less cluttered. So if you were to make a list of all the unnecessary things in your lives, you'd probably end up with a very, very long list indeed. But it can also take a very, very long time to give any of them up. And I think that's because some of us think giving up something is a form of sacrifice. And also actually parting with things can be quite a painful wrench at times. But it shouldn't really be like that. I mean, it's often just the stories that we add to the experience. I remember when my father died, he had what I thought was a lovely camera. He used to do a lot of photography. And I convinced myself that I absolutely had to have that camera. And his kind of estate was all tied up with the public trust, so I had to go through quite a process to get this camera. And when I finally got the camera, it was broken. It just quickly became a liability. I had to get rid of it, and it really didn't have the sort of deep connection with my father that I had thought it had to begin with. So in the end, it was quite easy to give it up. But I made up the story. I had to have this camera. It was going to somehow keep my father close to me. And Sangharakshita says that from a Buddhist point of view, it's not so much giving up as growing up. It shouldn't be a sacrifice for a spiritually mature person or one bordering on spiritual maturity to give up the things that we no longer need. And if we've seen to some degree the inadequacy of material things, then our hold on them will naturally relax and we will become quite willing and happy to at least let some of them go. So I know from my own experiences that I've actually given up quite a lot of material possessions and particular situations in my life, especially around 7 years ago or so. And some of it, and I was very deeply attached to the possessions and the situation, and some of it was very quite painful. It was a painful wrench to kind of let it go. But what I actually became aware of over time is that I didn't miss the material possessions at all, and I realised that the actual situation didn't serve me anymore, and it actually opened a great sort of door of freedom and transformation in actual fact. But other processes of renunciation have taken me naturally, have come about naturally over a long period of time, and probably a good example in Buddhism is that of becoming a vegetarian. I didn't sort of do that straight away. I mean, for a long time, I still ate fish, but I actually, and this was quite a few years ago, but eventually I just couldn't do it anymore. It was just like something fell away, and it just became kind of abhorrent, really, to me, to eat the flesh of beings that have been killed, just purely from an ethical perspective. So that was something that just fell away naturally in the end. I couldn't do it anymore. And moving into the women's community where I've been living for the past 6 years, nearly 7 years maybe, going into my seventh year. Well, not going into my seventh year because I'm going away. Well, I hope to have a seventh year at some point. That was actually an incredible opportunity to let go of being a conventional householder, and something that I probably wouldn't naturally have chosen unless circumstances had unfolded to lead to that. But I found the experience quite liberating, actually, not to be in charge of a house anymore, to be able to share that, and to kind of slowly let go of that kind of need to own possessions and own a house. And it's been a process, but luckily the women's community was just a perfect example of how you can live, and it was very supportive and continues to be so. But then, you know, what I did was I gave away a lot of my possessions to my daughters, and they've still got some of them today, and I do not want them back because there's been kids jumping all over them and they look pretty grubby. But I also stored quite a few things in my a spare bedroom at my mother's, and then I kind of pretended I just sort of forgotten about them, but I knew really it was just very hard to actually go back and start going through those possessions because of all the kind of memories that were attached to them. And it wasn't until about 5 years later when my mother kind of said to me in a very kind way, Natalie, she calls me Natalie, you know, it's been 5 years and I know this is really painful for you, but I think it's time. And she was right, she was very wise. And so that same weekend that she said that, I just went in there and went through all my possessions and got rid of them. And I basically now only got what is left in my room at the women's community. It's quite a large room and there's probably too much in it, but yeah. I also remember another very strong experience of having to give up a house. And I had spent quite a bit of time in my last year in that house decorating it. And I kind of knew that it had to be sold, but I do remember finishing the painting and sitting in my sitting room and really admiring what I'd done and really enjoying, you know, really kind of savouring the aesthetics of the place. And I was sitting in this beautiful kind of tapestry favourite armchair, just kind of resting there, thinking, you know, why shouldn't I just be able to stay in this place and just rest a while and move when I feel ready, you know? Why do I have to go now? And then I just realised, you know, I cannot even hang on to this armchair. Everything in that experience was impermanent. Everything was changing, and I actually couldn't hold on to anything. So I had to give it up. And I, you know, that momentary kind of feeling of wanting to fight for something and hang on to it just faded away when I realised that. But, you know, maybe the hardest form of renunciation is giving up the beliefs and views that define our sense of how and what we are. And Buddhism isn't actually asking us to replace our old beliefs for new ones, updated ones even. It's helping us to experience letting go of old beliefs and fixed views so that we can just be open to being in the space that is relatively free from our former rigidities. So just, you know, loosening up and just being in that space. And rather than thinking we just have to shrug off our views, which is very difficult to do, we could see this as a process of being open to slowly loosening any tightly held attitudes that we have. And we all have them. Yeah, they're very kind of prevalent. So a good way to put this into practice is next time you meet somebody new. Because most of us have judgments that come in very quickly. You know, we pigeonhole people. We look at them, we think, you know, they're a certain way, or we kind of make up a story based on past experiences, or we kind of mistrust. And actually, this has been, it's been a big lesson for me, this working with new people, being here in my role at the centre. Just some of the people who come through the door, you know, watching my kind of automatic reactions, and then time and time again having my judgments kind of shattered, really, after just talking to people for a while and giving them the time. Yeah, and probably, you know, there might be situations out in the world where I wouldn't take the time to get to know some people, but because I'm in this role here, and I'm often here on my own during the day, I'm kind of the one that they come to, and I kind of have to stay engaged, or it's very rude if I suddenly say I've got to kind of go off somewhere else. Or so I've learned to, you know, really watch my judgments about people. And it's not to say I'm over that, but, you know, to have noticed how they've been very wrong at times. And I've been incredibly moved by that experience too. So Buddhism is asking us to go beyond belief and examine our direct experience. And it's said that above the doors to awakening is written abandon or fear. And entering through the doors of awakening, which is another word for enlightenment, requires a letting go. And what we need to let go of is our fear of change. And in letting go of our fear of change, we go forth into the impermanent nature of reality. And when we were on the Taste of Freedom retreat, we used a really beautiful poem of Rumi's to kind of, we kept coming back to it. I can't remember who was here, who was there on that retreat. Yeah, I think you like the poem. Yeah. It's kind of rather cryptic, but it's very beautiful. And we just kept on delving into it deeper and deeper. And I just wanted to share that with you because I think it is a really beautiful description of going forth. So it goes like this. Last night my teacher taught me the lesson of poverty, having nothing and wanting nothing. I am a naked woman standing inside a mine of rubies clothed in red silk. I absorb the shining and now I see the ocean. Billions of simultaneous motions moving in me. A circle of lovely, quiet people becomes the ring on my finger. Then the wind and thunder of rain on the way. I have such a teacher. I'll read that again. Last night my teacher taught me the lesson of poverty, having nothing and wanting nothing. I am a naked woman standing inside a mine of rubies clothed in red silk. I absorb the shining and now I see the ocean, billions of simultaneous motions moving in me. A circle of lovely, quiet people becomes the ring on my finger. Then the wind and thunder of rain on the way. I have such a teacher. So in Buddhism, we aim to let go of old habits and go forth into our direct experience of life and stand naked and free from our rigid beliefs and views. And this nakedness symbolizes being open to our direct experience of the richness that is unfolding all around us all of the time. And it's said that in this opening, we become full of life, saturated by it. And the role of Buddhism is to help us stand in that space of openness and be with the thunder and rain without fear. And I'll kind of touch into that a little bit further on with the worldly ones. But we can do this through our everyday experience of life, through looking closely at our experience and allowing that looking to bring a new level of awareness to what is actually happening. And this awareness could lead towards change, towards the unknown, towards the letting go and stepping outside of the expected norms. It could lead us to examine the beliefs that have given us a perceived security and have essentially bound us to an unsatisfactory life. And the answers that come from that could point us towards a going forth. And, you know, sometimes, as I've already kind of hinted at, this going forth can arise as a result of a sudden upheaval. And we all come to points in our lives when things can break down. And it could be through external events like someone dying, a broken marriage or a relationship, or just a slow kind of simmering build-up of internal dissatisfaction. And sometimes at certain points our normal existence seems to just come apart at the seams. And these can be painful and very difficult times, but they can also be incredible opportunities for transformation and growth. So, you know, when these situations happen and we feel that kind of point of change coming, it can be very helpful to just stay in the gaps that can arise in such situations and dwell for a time in the bardo. The word bardo means gap that is created there. And, you know, do the best we can to see it as an opportunity to change, to let go of our fixed views of who we are. And in the root verses of the Tibetan bardo, todol, there's advice offered to support positive change. And there are six verses, and the fifth is known as the bardo of reality. And it begins, "Oh, now when the bardo of reality upon me is dawning, abandoning all awe, fear, and terror of all phenomena, may I recognize whatever appeareth as being my own thought forms. May I know them to be apparitions in the intermediate state. It hath been said there arriveth a time when the chief turning point is reached. Fear not the bands of the peaceful and wrathful, who are thine own thought forms." I'll read that again. "O now when the bardo of reality upon me is dawning, abandoning all awe, fear, and terror of all phenomena, may I recognize whatever appeareth as being mine own thought forms. May I know them to be apparitions in the intermediate state. It hath been said, there arriveth a time when the chief turning point is reached. Fear not the bands of the peaceful and wrathful, who are thine own thought forms." So a bardo can mean a state in which our normal hold on a perceived reality is loosened. And we can commonly react in this gap or bardo with fear because we have a desire to cling and grasp to the known. It's very strongly ingrained in us. But even though these situations can appear to be frightening, they can also offer us a great opportunity for change. Because, you know, when we die, and we all will, everybody in this room will die one day. Not too soon, I hope. When we die, we are torn from all we hold dear. All our dreams and ideas are suddenly seen as lacking any real substance. But even whilst we are alive, we have opportunities to see this, especially when our tightly held views about ourselves and others are challenged. So Buddhism is asking us to take notice of the experiences of our lives and in doing so to let go of clinging to our fixed ideas and beliefs. And when we do that, we create a gap for new and creative responses to unfold. So as I said earlier, over New Year's at Sudarshan Loka, Kusumani and I co-led a five-day retreat on the worldly winds, also known as the Loka Dharmas. And these can be very helpful for working with our habitual tendencies. And the worldly winds are actually four pairs of opposites, if you're not familiar with them already, and they are pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and infamy. And what we tend to do as human beings, we oscillate between these pairs of opposites. And what we're actually doing is we're oscillating between craving and aversion. So, you know, we crave pleasure constantly and we have an aversion towards pain. So we push away pain. We have a tendency to accumulate and think we need more and more. And we really don't like losing things. We have an aversion to losing things or to loss in general, whatever form that takes. We really enjoy praise, so we can start to, you know, crave praise, but we really don't want to be blamed for anything or have blame. And everybody likes to be a little bit famous, but we don't enjoy infamy. So this all ties in with the traditional Buddhist teachings around the three poisons of craving and aversion and delusion. And the reason we're suffering all the time with craving and aversion is because we are deluded. And that these three poisons are symbolised by the rooster and the pig and the snake that go round and round constantly on the wheel of life, each with the tail of the other in their mouths, and just on this endless round of grasping and clinging and pushing things away. And they're called the worldly ones because they're kind of unpredictable. I mean, we like to think that we have control in our life, but actually we don't have nearly as much control over things as what we think. We can be, you know, we can really work at making wise choices and setting up good conditions and being ethical and, you know, following the Buddhist precepts. But there's always going to be unforeseen things that occur, and we're never going to get away from the fact as human beings that we will all at some point grow old and die or get sick, which usually comes first, doesn't it, unless it's a sudden death. So we just don't have, you know, we try to kind of grasp on and have control of our lives, but ultimately we don't have control. So these worldly ones can be either pleasant or unpleasant, and they can take us where we don't want to go. They can be destructive, and they can bring good or bad weather. But it's not actually the winds themselves that cause the problem, it's our reaction to them. So often we don't have the control that we think we have, as I just said, or would like to have. We want to fix our lives in a particular way, rather than going with the flow of how things are. And we find change difficult. And we want the pleasant ones, but we don't want the unpleasant ones. And, you know, we often feel our life isn't okay at all unless it's pleasant. We have the pleasant ones all the time. So when we're caught up between oscillating opposites, we can feel trapped. And we can, you know, fear things and continuously, you know, want something else to alleviate that fear. But the great thing is, so it's being aware of these worldly ones that we don't actually have as much control over them as what we think. And there are ways that we can cultivate better mind states to kind of deal with them. And in Buddhism, with the worldly ones, we have what's known as Dharma doors that can give us a way out, an alternative way of dealing with the ups and downs of life. And they're a way to let go of our habitual ways of being, our clinging to fixed ideas of how things should be. And what they can do is help us, and Buddhism in general can help us to explore a more creative response to difficult situations. So these Dharma doors connect us with qualities that support creative rather than our, you know, sometimes reactive or usual reactive responses. And these are the qualities of the enlightened mind, qualities such as mindfulness, awareness, generosity, truthfulness, metta, which is loving kindness, courage, patience, fearlessness, positivity, integrity, and individuality. And these qualities are embodied in the wisdom of the Buddhas, and they can help to connect us with something beyond ourselves. And you know, they can help us to they can give us faith or shraddha, that there is another way. There's a way beyond our kind of fixed views of who we are and who others are and how the world is. And in Buddhism, these are symbolised by the five archetypal Buddhas, often symbolised by the five archetypal Buddhas. And each of the archetypal Buddhas reflect particular qualities. You know, they have a strong quality that they kind of reflect of the awakened mind. And they're also symbolised by different colours, and they form a mandala, and they all sit in different directions on the mandala. And they have a particular mantra, and they're even accompanied by their own particular animal. I can't go into all that too deeply tonight, but I am going to touch on one of them in the shrine room, and maybe towards the end of this talk as well. So these archetypal Buddhas help to connect with something beyond ourselves, something transcendental, something mysterious and beautiful, beyond the mundane, beyond the rational. And they work through the power of our imaginations, because, you know, we as human beings have incredible capacity to use our imaginations, and if we can harness that in a skillful way, it can be very transformative. So the spiritual life is a life of renunciation on so many levels, and every day, every minute of the day, as an opportunity to meet the challenge of letting be, letting go, and freeing ourselves from habitual patterns and behaviours that ultimately as you might have guessed by now, you know, create suffering for us, or you know, keep us in that kind of that whirlwind of suffering. There's a really lovely, my favourite poem of Sangharakshita's, our founder, which alludes to this kind of going forth and renunciation that I want to share. It's called The Lotus of Compassion. The lotus blooms tonight, the great golden lotus of the Lord's compassion, with white roots deep in the slime of the sad world, and huge green leaves spread on the surface of the waters of the Lake of Tears, and surrounded by myriads of silver lotus buds, like white hands folded in prayer for succour from the mysteries of the world. The lotus blooms tonight. Oh, leave the crowded shore where men buy and sell. Shake off the soft detaining fingers of your friends, and in a little boat at midnight when the moon is full and glitters at you from the water, row swiftly to the quiet heart of the lake where the lotus blooms, the great golden lotus of the Lord's compassion, and you will feel the sweetness ineffable of its heart fragrance coming on a breeze which ripples the face of the silent waters to meet you beneath the stars. You know, I love that line, or those lines, oh, leave the crowded shore where men or women buy and sell. Shake off the soft detaining fingers of your friends, and I'd like to add in family. Yeah. You know, and it just really alludes to the kind of mystery of life and that sort of longing we have to kind of go forth, to do something different. And it can take a lot of courage. So, yeah, and Sujiva mentioned earlier that I'm about to go away, and so it is a kind, and I'd like to say Suchata is coming as well, so we both, you know, she's given up a lot this year as well. I gave up a lot a few years ago, and I'm still giving up more and more. I don't think we ever finish giving up things, actually. Ultimately we give up our life, but I know it's been huge for her as well, especially the last few weeks or months. And even though the doorways to go to live and work at Akashavana opened quite freely and easily, actually, I was surprised too. We were, you know, I don't know, maybe they were desperate. but you know, we're doing this, we're going, and they were very excited about us going, and they really do want, they do need people there. So it does feel like a, you know, huge change. And the people, the Sangha, have been incredibly supportive. I mean, I was very nervous, actually, about doing this for a while, and I wondered how people here would, you know, take it. But I just feel incredibly lucky and grateful that I think most Buddhists would understand that it's a really good thing to do, that it's sort of, and it is quite a big thing to do. But mostly what I've been working through is leaving members of my family, actually, feeling quite a lot of guilt, and I've been realising recently that most of the guilt is not because my family think I'm doing a bad thing, it's my own projections around, you know, abandoning my family, I suppose, my elderly mother and my daughters, although, you know, I'm not too worried about leaving my daughters, I hope they don't listen to the talk, but, you know, I know it's really my mother, actually, because she's 89 and... But she's been incredible. She's really pushing me to go, and she's, you know, quite strong about it. So it's just been lovely. But, you know, I've worked through quite a lot. And I have to say, you know, there's little kind of renunciations going on all the time. And I've had to, what I wasn't really expecting and what came up was how attached I am to my role here, how comfortable I've got, actually, and how I realised after having huge changes a few years ago in my life, I kind of hurled myself on the funeral pyre of the Dharma, actually, and just totally immersed myself here and completely changed my life. But I'm kind of getting comfortable again. And it's a bit like the situation of sitting in the armchair and realising, you know, that everything is changing. Nothing's, not even this is permanent. And a big realisation for me is that I'm not getting any younger. In fact, I'm I just turned 59, and I realised if I don't do this now, you know, in another few years I might not be able to. And I think actually growing older is a great sort of, I think it really helps overcome fear. You just start to realise, well, if there's something you really want to do, you better get on with it, because time is short, you know, yeah. And the place that we're going is quite mountainous, and there's going to be some challenges on our bodies. My knees are already a bit rickety, and that kind of just, you know, made me think I better do this now. So, I just realised that we're continuously kind of redefining and recreating our lives. Even when we go through big changes and we think we've let go of a lot, we kind of get back into our habitual way of, you know, getting comfortable, kind of shoring up the self. Yeah, it's very hard to kind of break free of that. And I think we had to continuously challenge ourselves, actually, every few years to, just to keep that in mind. And I think, you know, I knew that I have this kind of inclination to take on more and more responsibility. But I had a bit of stuff was happening this year where I suddenly kind of thought, I do that naturally. I've been quite willing. I've been able, and I've really enjoyed everything I've done. But am I really deepening my practice? You know, there was something I really wanted to. I had this yearning for spaciousness and to explore some creativity. And I didn't really know how I was going to do it, and this just has turned out to be a wonderful opportunity to explore that. I had been working with fear of change, fear of losing the familiar, letting go of roles, people not knowing me. You know, I do remember I spent 3 months in the UK and Spain about three years ago, and I just relished everybody. I must have that look about me that people think I know, you know, even to do with running a centre or whatever. And here I know quite a lot, but over there I didn't know a thing. But people would still come up to me and say, oh, do you know where this is? Or do you know how that works? And I just love saying, I have no idea. And eventually I was smiling, I just have no idea, it's fantastic. You know, and I'm kind of looking forward to that as well, just being free of that for a while. And an old teacher of mine, Taranatha, who died a few years ago, I remember him, he used to say in some of our classes, and I used to reflect on this. In fact, I reflected a great deal on it when my marriage broke up. He used to say that he would ask himself, if I didn't have my job, my relationship, my house, my role, what would I be? You know, if I lost everything that defined who I was, what would be left? And they're quite big questions to ask yourself and to reflect on. And they're not easy questions to answer, but I think they're well worth reflecting on. And they're very. This is all very closely related to the worldly ones of gain and loss and fame and infamy. This fear, you know, this realization or knowing that you can be important and everybody knows you 1 minute and the next minute you're not, you're invisible. And there are all times when we feel loved by others and popular, and times where we feel incredibly lonely. I mean, even if we don't go and do something new, we can feel that, can't we? And there are times when we all wonder, what on earth will people think of me? So we're always oscillating between this sort of delight and dejection, being inflated, then deflated. So if we can just sort of be curious about the underlying feeling of elation or dejection, we can start to kind of be open to the Dharma doorway that can help us to deal with that, to be more equanimous with it. And the Dharma doorway for fame and infamy is actually that of integrity and individuality. And this integrity and individuality is all about becoming confident about our speech and actions, being ethical. We can do this by aspiring to follow the Buddhist precepts of causing no harm, practicing simplicity and contentment, truthful, kindly, helpful, harmonious communication, mindfulness, and being aware of how things really are. And it's about having the awareness to really know ourselves and what our values and priorities are, but also being open to this changing. And having, you know, sometimes having the courage to really be ourselves means going against popular opinion or going against what others, you know, expect of us or how others see us or define us. Other people will be very ready to tell you, you know, what your particular role is or, you know, and it can be hard to kind of go against that, especially with family. And this is where, you know, our sense of value and worth comes from our inner values and the relationships with people that we love and who love us, and especially, I think, in the Sangha, in the spiritual community, because we're all on that path together of transformation and becoming a true individual, whilst also knowing that we're, you know, deeply connected. And it's very different. Becoming a true individual is very different to individualism, where we're sort of out there in the world trying to grasp, you know, to accumulate everything, to shore up our kind of roles, you know, asserting ourselves over and above other people to get what we want. It's becoming a true individual. To become a true individual, we need a great deal of metta and an awareness of other people and our connection, both, you know, to be aware of ourselves as individuals, but also aware of other individuals and our interconnection with the whole of life. So just to close, I wanted to share a poem. I wrote about this, and some of you have heard this on the Midsummer Magic Retreat, about this process of casting adrift. Oh, to fall through into fearlessness, alive in each moment as the first, as the last, entering through doorways that have always been there, shrouded by veils now worn and frayed, turning towards those plaintive longings, whispering through cracks between habits and roles, nudged by awareness of years unfolding, indifferent to the clingings of comfortable lives, unravelling the notions of what we are here for, defined by the boundaries of those we hold dear, casting adrift in an uncertain ocean, surrendering to faith, embracing the stream. I think I've kind of run out of time. I had some other things, but I did want to mention that, going back to the five Buddhas, you know, the Akitoba Buddhas, that Amoghasiddhi is the Buddha who exemplifies the Dharma door of becoming a true individual and developing integrity. And mostly he's about developing fearlessness and courage. And he has a mudra. His mudra is his right hand, sort of, you know, up here, and the kind of mudra of fearlessness and authority and strength. And there's a really lovely story. You know, if you're not really into these archetypal Buddhas, there's a little story that might help you to understand the meaning of it a bit further. It's in Sutra's book, Meeting the Buddhas, where he talks at the very end of the chapter around the Amoghasiddhi. I highly recommend this book. About a group of three mountaineers. They were all Dharma practitioners, people that he knew. I think he knew them anyway. He said it's a true story. These three mountaineers going off into the mountains in Scotland. And one of them, you know, has an accident and falls off the mountain, and he actually falls over 200 feet. And his climbing companions are quite certain he'd be either seriously injured or, you know, very possibly dead. And so they eventually kind of make their way down to find him at the bottom of this crevice. And he's lying there with two broken ankles, and he's laughing. And they, you know, they kind of eventually sort of find out from him that the reason he's laughing is because when he was falling, he's been an Amoghasiddhi practitioner. He's had an Amoghasiddhi visualization for years and years and years. And as he was falling, he had the best visualization of Amoghasiddhi in his entire life. Amoghasiddhi just had the mudra of fearlessness up, and all fear just dropped away, and he landed, and he had two broken ankles. But yeah. So, you know, you can question whether they're real or not, but they can really work. Yeah. I'll leave it there.